screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Goods, a film podcast. This is Brian. Are you there, Dan?
Hey, Brian. I'm here.
We're in the midst of a special theme month, which we do from time to time throughout the year. This was a theme month concocted by Dan, where the focus is on debuts, the first outing of some creative personality. We've gone directors so far. Do you think it's going to be all directorial debuts, Dan? Do you want to declare that at this point?
I don't know what I'm doing for my last pick yet, so I do not want to declare that.
Sounds good. Well, anyway, this selection that I have made is a directorial debut. At least it was their first feature. It's a film by Daniels. Last episode I said The Daniels. Dan said that's incorrect. And by and large, I've consulted materials over the past week that do refer to them as Daniels, without the V. So their first feature, after they'd come up through doing various visually inventive music videos, was the 2016 film Swiss Army Man, which is indeed what I have assigned for today. So Dan, what did you know about this movie?
I had never seen this movie prior to this week. I knew that it was the farting corpse movie, and that it was the first movie by the duo that would subsequently make Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is a major touch point for me, for this movie, for Daniels. Although that's not the only Daniels work that I've seen. I want to talk about something else Daniels related here in a minute. But, you know, obviously it's kind of got a eyebrow-raising premise, and the scuttlebutt on it from you and from other people I'd heard is that it went some emotionally intense directions, basically. And we'll see just how much that bears out when we talk through it.
Yes. So just a couple things here at the start, listeners. I saw the trailer for this movie, and maybe even just a teaser trailer for this movie back in 2016, which just had the opening scene where the corpse washes up on the beach and starts farting. And then shortly thereafter, it's doing more tricks. And the human man is interacting with the corpse and using it for things. Many different purposes. And the corpse is Daniel Radcliffe. So the logline for this film that I would say is Daniel Radcliffe is the corpse of a thousand uses. You know immediately if you want to watch that movie.
I think a couple of important context points on there. So one is 2016. When did the last Harry Potter came out? Harry Potter 8.
Was that like 2008 or something?
2011.
Okay.
So this was 5 years after the Harry Potter saga ended. And I think we hadn't quite gotten to the point. We were starting to get to the point of realizing what the Daniel Radcliffe experience post Harry Potter was going to be like. Basically, immensely lovable British guy, does just whatever his heart tells him. He's got all the money he's ever going to need with his Harry Potter residuals. So he's just going to do the things that make him happy, and tends to make fans happy too with what he does, and generally regarded as a nice, likable guy. And I still think we didn't quite know that when he made a farting corpse movie with Paul Dano, who is also interesting. And I think this is, you know, just a couple of years after he had really risen to the zeitgeist with, first he did Little Miss Sunshine in 06, and then he did There Will Be Blood, which I have not seen, but which was like a major critical touch point for him. He's never had an Oscar nomination, but I think he has the reputation that matches or exceeds many Oscar nominated actors.
Right. So yeah, lots of things to touch on here. We'll kind of spitball back and forth. This movie has an arc but it's not super crucial that you hit every single plot detail. So Paul Dano, I had seen There Will Be Blood. I need to watch it again because I feel like I didn't really get it. Because in that movie, there's Daniel Day-Lewis, and he's not very nice. He's just this greedy oil baron, and he's out for himself, and he's screwing everybody over. So, okay, the main central character is a bad guy. Well, then Paul Dano shows up, and he's like this dweeby preacher character who's always proselytizing, and like, he's not very likable either because he's like this wimpy guy and yet he's super self-righteous. So when he shows up, it's like, well, is this the good guy? Who is the good guy in this story? And I never really figured it out. And then at the end, somebody beats somebody to death with a bowling pin. So got to revisit that one. And the other thing I know Paul Dano from is he was Spielberg's dad in Fablemans.
I feel like Fablemans has come up enough to the pod. We'll see. But did you see last year's Batman movie?
No, I didn't. Who was he in that?
So he was the Riddler in that.
Oh, in that like weird trench coat outfit.
And he's a weirdo in that. And he's really good in that too. I mean, and I've seen him in a few other things. I saw him in this weird movie he starred in with his wife called Ruby Sparks. He just has a really intense presence. He's a little bit like a sort of geeky, gawky Joaquin Phoenix in some ways, because he's got the weirdo vibe, but it's not quite so abrasive as Joaquin Phoenix.
I can see that. You've talked up Ruby Sparks to me before, so I definitely have to check that one out. It seems like it would be up my alley.
It's strange, but it's pretty good. I mean, I saw it like in college or something, so I think I would react very differently to it now with all the life experience I have, but it's a pretty interesting one.
But so I saw this teaser trailer with the corpse on the beach that starts farting and propelling itself through the water. And I thought, this is hilarious. But also, this must be one of those cases where the trailer is the entire thing that they make. Like, you make this sort of a trailer to go into like a grindhouse from Quentin Tarantino where all you have is that like machete teaser trailer. And you know, maybe if the fans go nuts, you blow it up into something bigger. But no way is this trailer a whole movie. How does this get turned into a feature? And I wasn't sure. And I didn't finally get around to watching it until 2020. And I watched it, and I wasn't ready for what I got. It punched me in the gut. And so I've been saving this one for a while.
This would be a wild one to see with basically no context except a trailer and in the middle of a pandemic, I would say. Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been keeping this card in my vest to pull out at some point, and now seemed like the time. I actually ended up liking it even more this time, so we'll talk about it.
Oh, nice. There's something I need to talk about here, Brian.
All right.
And that is Turn Down for What? One of the best pop songs of the 2010s by Lil Jon. And I think the producer was DJ Snake or some, I don't know who it was. Some guy I don't know. But the day that we're recording this, Brian, is the Monday after the Super Bowl, the day after the Super Bowl. Did you watch the Super Bowl at all?
I did not. I heard the Chiefs won.
They did, yeah.
In overtime.
The halftime show was Usher. And Usher, one of his best and most famous songs is Yeah, which has Ludacris and Lil Jon in there. So each of them got to do little bits of their own music. Lil Jon did Turn Down for What, a verse of Turn Down for What. Now, the music video of Turn Down for What, also one of the best music videos of the 2010s, which is how I was introduced to Daniels. And so have you watched this music video, Turn Down for What, Brian?
No, but when I was watching the like 20-minute making of featurette for Swiss Army Man, it had some clips from their music videos. So they all looked pretty interesting, all had some off-the-wall physical gimmick that was at work. So what happens in this music video?
So it starts with a guy on top of a building. I think it's an apartment building. And the music starts, and he is not able to restrain himself from pelvic thrusting dancing. So it just grows wilder and wilder. And eventually he falls through the roof into a woman's apartment. Now, it turns out to be like a college best friend of Daniel's, who actually also met in college, is the co-star of this. And actually, one of the two Daniels plays the main character, the pelvic thrusting dancer in that, the Asian Daniel. I think it's, what is it, Daniel Kwan?
Kwan.
And what's the other Daniel's last name?
Scheinert.
Okay, yeah. Anyways, this guy's just falling through a roof. She's like taking a baseball bat to like try and get him out of it. And he just keeps pelvic thrusting dancing. He's like, he mounts the TV like the dog humping something. And eventually, like with one of his pelvic thrusts, like aimed towards her, a lot of her clothes come flying off. And it just gets more and more absurd. And it's immensely funny. And then she like gets into the partying, and then they fall down into this other family's house, and it just grows wackier and wackier. And it is such a funny music video. Like I said, one of my favorites. And honestly, like a lot of the physical humor shared across that and Swiss Army Man and Everything Everywhere All at Once, like more threads in the style of comedy and like the Baroque body humor than you might guess, or I don't know, but very interesting. So anyways, I thought it was interesting that last night turned down for what was on the Super Bowl halftime show, and then today we're talking about Swiss Army Man, their debut movie. By the way, I mentioned that Ludacris was also in the Super Bowl halftime show, so we also had some unexpected synergy with Jim Henson's Turkey Hollow. Was he the narrator of that?
Oh man. Every time I hear about that movie again, it's like I'm hearing about it for the first time, because I so thoroughly just, it washes off my memory. It's like, that's right, we watched that.
It has a way of exiting the brain, yeah.
But I'm not surprised to hear that there's consistent threads continuing on from the music videos into this film, because I also this week watched Everything Everywhere All at Once for my first time, and I did see some connections.
Oh, you did catch up with it. Cool.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that one probably a little bit. I think it's unavoidable. I mean, it swept the awards. It was like, it really cleaned up.
Well, I think that retroactively makes Swiss Army Man more significant, because their next movie won Best Picture and they won Best Director for it. So like the entire collective movie making apparatus in the United States acknowledging them as the best director in the world for a year. That's kind of something.
And writers.
That's right. Did they win it for screenplay too?
Yeah, they did.
And this was their debut, the film they made before it, the farting Harry Potter corpse movie.
Right. It was kind of the incubator. So I've got some notes here from the template that Dan used last episode, things about the directors who debuted with this film. And we've covered some of this information already, but I'll try to pull some of these things in. So, Dan, what would you say is your favorite work by them? Or is this a question that we hold for the end when we rate?
I think we'll hold that one for the end, especially with this, because I think you inevitably have basically comparing this to Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Cool.
I also think it's worth noting, and we can maybe talk a little bit more about the general reaction to this towards the end, but Everything Everywhere All at Once, like, blew the doors off of critics. Like it's probably in the 90s on Rotten Tomatoes. And for a while, it was the single highest rated movie in movie history on Letterboxd, which is kind of crazy. Letterboxd starting to get hit with what plagued IMDb, which is when a new movie comes out that a lot of people like, it gets flooded with 5 stars and like ranks it above like Seven Samurai and stuff, you know. But also, Everything Everywhere All at Once made well over $100 million. And this movie made significantly less than that. So this movie, I think, was in the 70s on Rotten Tomatoes. So that's divisive, but still generally liked territory, I think.
Right. And I think there's a bar to entry. I described the premise to my parents, and they were unreceptive. Like, you're watching a movie about abusing a corpse? It's like, well, yeah. So the budget of this film, $3 million, took in less than $6 million at the box office.
$3 million, I gotta say, it looks good for a $3 million movie.
Used well. yeah, we'll talk about what you're seeing and what you're hearing in this film, because I think it delivers on both the auditory and aural fronts. So when this movie starts out, we do indeed get that scene from the trailer where Hank, Paul Dano, is it Dano or Dano, or do we know?
I say Dano, but I'm not sure I've actually heard that out loud.
Okay, yeah, in this movie, so we've got Daniel and Daniel and Daniel and Dano.
The Dans.
Right, Dan Club representing. And so Paul Dano is trapped on what seems to be a deserted island. He's on this beach, he's all alone, and he's trying to hang himself. He's like about to step off the box and have the noose tighten. Which reminds me a little bit of part of Castaway. Do you remember that? There's a point, like it jumps ahead 4 years, and you don't see Tom Hanks actually hanging himself, but he like makes a reference to at some point during the 4 years, he like set up a dummy and threw it off a cliff and it broke the rope. He's like, it's good that I didn't do that because I would have broken my legs.
I do remember that, yeah. Definitely some Castaway vibes here, because you also have, in Castaway, you have Wilson.
Right. But so Paul Dano's got this noose around his neck, and to be fair, I don't know that he's really trying, because the way this set is set up is he's got the noose hanging like down from the top of a cave, and the rope looks like it's like 40 feet long, and like, don't do it at ground level, jump off the top of the cave with it around your neck. That's going to do a lot more. But anyway.
Well, I still think you're probably right on the logistics of that. I've never learned too much about the physics of hanging yourself. I actually do know it's a very well-studied field because they used to hang a lot of people, of course. And so they needed to figure out, it was really messy if the person's head came off. So they had like a lot of stuff of getting the materials right and the drop distance right, because you also want to make sure the person dies, you know. But I think it opens the possibility of reading this as like sort of a death rattle hallucination of his, or like at least letting go of absolutely everything about himself to kind of rebuild it, basically.
Oh, absolutely. There's metaphorical stuff at work here, and we'll talk about what exactly we think it means, quote unquote. But yeah, it could be like an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, the short story by Ambrose Bierce, where there's a Civil War prisoner who's getting hanged, and he imagines this whole story of escaping through the woods and like reuniting with his family, and then the final line of the story is the noose tightened. And it's like, oh, in just the, you know, the like split second that he was falling, he imagines this whole story. But while he's standing on the box and about to step off, he sees out in the surf that deceased Daniel Radcliffe washes up. And so he gets himself, well, actually, I guess the noose does break. He like, you know, is surprised, falls off the box, the noose breaks. And so he stumbles out there into the sand and he finds the Daniel Radcliffe corpse. And while he's inspecting it, the corpse starts to fart loudly and forcibly, to the point that it starts puttering through the waves like a motorboat. In the featurette, Daniels called it a motor butt. And so Hank hops onto the corpse and rides it through the waves. And we get the big flash of the title card, Swiss Army Man. Apparently this was the visual that the filmmakers came up with first. This is the thing they wanted to realize, was riding a dead guy through the sea, being blasted along by the fart.
Yeah, I did listen to about half of the director's commentary. I found it online and listened to it. And they did talk a lot about that, about how basically it kind of just started as an image for them. And they decided, like, well, what if we made it the most grand and beautiful version of that image? What would that look like? And that was kind of their starting point.
Yeah, this movie will make you question what really is the distinction between highbrow and lowbrow art, and is that a valuable distinction? It kind of makes me think about how you read that Mozart was really into scatological humor. Like, he just loved joking about farting and shitting. And I guess that's something that concerns us all, even the so-called geniuses.
One thing I'll say about this movie that I found fascinating is I want to kind of deconstruct this once we get towards the end in particular, is this movie has a lot of dualities in it. You have a lot of A versus B, the contrast between A and B. And I think, like, just at a high level, that was like kind of the guiding impetus. And I think in some ways there's some themes I want to talk about that are kind of the contrast of A and B. But in particular, like you said, the what if you made a movie that is like that scatological on the outside and just made it as thoughtful as possible? Exactly what you're saying. And I think that's like that reverberates, that echoes through so many of the things that happen within the movie too.
For sure. And I also want to say here early on that I recommend experiencing this movie fresh. Don't let us spoil it for you, because it is a movie that can be spoiled, I think. I've tried not to spoil it for Dan. Like, I watched it pretty much as soon as I could once I announced that this was going to be what we would watch, and I've been cranking the soundtrack all week. But I couldn't send those tracks to Dan, because I didn't want him to get clues.
I think that's true to some extent. Like, some of the places it goes, particularly like the, oh wow, it's really going there aspect, I would say is kind of spoilable. But I also think you can describe it and still not understand the experience of watching it, because there's just the energy about it that you just can't quantify or describe. And honestly, the only thing that really has the same sort of like maximalism, something taken to the nth degree in the same way, is Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's got a lot of the same, like, just taking the very concept of it and blasting it out to infinity.
So Hank and the dead body are going across the waves, and eventually they do make it to this other shore, which seems to be on the mainland of wherever they came from. By the way, no explanation of how Hank ever ended up out on the island. They just never really bring it up. But they get to this mainland and yet are still far from civilization. They got to trek through this forest to get back to wherever they're bound. So they spend their first night in a cave. And again, I just want to stress that we're not going to be too into the weeds about specific events in this film, because it really is about the vibe and the themes that you end up exploring. But it's important to talk about this cave, because while they're in the cave, it rains and water pours into Daniel Radcliffe's mouth, and we discover another power that this corpse has is that it can endlessly vomit forth fresh drinking water. Which you're going to need when you're on a big trip through the wilderness. But if there's anything in this movie that squicked me out, it's drinking water that has come out of a corpse. Like, just don't... I don't want to drink fluid that has come out of a corpse. Maybe that's just me.
I watched this movie with my wife, and we're on the same page as you. This is the grossest thing in the movie. A movie that's got poops and boners and stuff. The water coming out of his gurgling throat is the single grossest image in the film.
Really loved in the featurette watching Daniel Radcliffe practice with this hose that goes through his mouth and how he can control exactly how it spurts and like his influence over the stream.
The making of featurette is worth watching on its own even. It's got a lot of really good stuff in it. They made a lot of like fake prosthetic Daniel Radcliffe's and parts of Daniel Radcliffe to like appear in different contexts within the film. It made me laugh.
Daniel Radcliffe's performance in this movie is amazing, because I keep forgetting he's a real person. Like, whenever he'll fall over limp, I think he's a doll man. And watching this featurette, there's bloopers of him cracking up and laughing. And it reminds me, oh yeah, he was a person there with, like, human experiences.
Except in some of it, it is just, like, a body. And it's well done enough. You can't always tell when it is and when it isn't him. And it's a great and unusual performance because there's just not many things to compare it to. It's sui generis. It's like a one-of-a-kind performance. He's pretending to be a dead body, but like that does involuntarily does gross stuff and can be ridden like a motorboat and ends up having more depth than that. It's just so bizarre, but he really, really sells it. So, yeah.
Yeah. I really have not seen a movie like this, except maybe Everything Everywhere All at Once. But we'll talk when we get to the end here, which we eventually will, about differences and similarities between the two films. So now Hank is carrying Danny Radcliffe around on his back through the forest like a camelback backpack with the water inside. But Daniel Radcliffe starts developing progressively more abilities. It's like he's starting to come to life, which soon includes the power of speech. And when he first talks, I love this moment, because Paul Dano says he's, you know, like Wilson the volleyball, he's kind of passively speaking to him. And he says, okay, buddy. And the clip says, okay, buddy.
It's a really funny moment.
Have you ever read the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark books?
I've read portions of it.
One of the scariest stories to me is called Harold, and it's about these two guys who are like shepherds up in the mountains, and they work in isolation, and they make a scarecrow, and they start talking to the scarecrow, and then suddenly one day the scarecrow starts talking back. And then it gains the ability to start walking around. And it's becoming more and more alive. So some of that here in this story, but funnier. And nobody gets their skin peeled off. As Daniel Radcliffe is becoming more sentient, Hank, Paul Dano, starts teaching him about life. So that's kind of the arc of this movie, is Daniel Radcliffe is coming to life, and Hank is going to be his teacher. And through these lessons, we learn that Hank himself actually doesn't know that much about life. What it makes me think of is if you were going to teach somebody to cook, but based just on looking at the finished dish. Like, you don't know anything about the ingredients that go into a cake, but you are shown a cake and told to make the cake. It would be hard. You might do some idiosyncratic things. Are you following what I'm laying down, Dan?
I think so. Basically that, like, through what is ostensibly teaching Manny, by the way, Manny for this corpse that starts with no personality and gradually gains it. It made me think of, like, how Frankenstein calls his monster Adam, basically, you know, the first man. But it gradually, over the course of the film, becomes obvious just how broken Hank, Paul Dano's character, is, and how depressed he is, I guess, and how, like, repressed his life has been so far. And so I definitely think that that tracks. And sometimes it matters. Sometimes the movie is just kind of pushing the absurdism, like when it has, like, a really direct conversation about masturbation or poop or stuff. I don't know how much that tells us about Hank. Sometimes it tells us a little bit, but sometimes it's just being kind of wacky about it. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'll point out now that somewhere along the way, Hank plugs Manny's butt with a cork to stop the constant farting. Like, that's an important plot point, which maybe gives you some of the flavor. But the themes, the, like, isolation and learning to be a human and bust out of that, resonated with me. These woods that they're wandering through are full of trash. like there's a lot of just junk food wrappers and things littered around in this beautiful wilderness. By the way, this aspect ratio is pretty wild, which I only noticed this time. Like, what would you call this? It's like super widescreen.
Well, I didn't really notice it, which means I think it's... Aren't most movies super widescreen? Let me look up what the aspect ratio was. Is it even more so than normal? I'm not the best at noticing aspect ratios.
It felt really wide to me this time.
So it's 2.4 to 1, which I think is not that uncommon. It does feel a little odd in a indie movie. It feels like it's trying to be more blockbuster style than you would expect from a $3 million movie.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the best Trash in the Woods movie ever made.
Well, what are some of the other Trash in the Woods movies, Brian?
Well, there's not a lot of competition, but Hank uses all this junk for his visual aids and his teaching of Manny, and he starts constructing all these things. So, puppets, and he like has this roll of paper that he draws a wilderness scene on, and then he can crank a gear and it turns the paper so that it can be like a scrolling Hanna-Barbera background, so that then when they build a bus, they can simulate that the world is going by outside the bus windows.
I think the trash is really important. There's a few things about it that are important. So one is this goes back to like the dualities and like the two ideas contrasting each other. So the fact that Paul Dano's character Hank is using trash to literally like explain the beautiful things in life and like what life is really like. And oh, you go and you get a sense of the wonder of nature and you feel romance and you feel these great human feelings with trash and wrappers is like adding to this sense that there's like two sides of life that Daniels are exploring with this film. There's like the elemental, physical, gritty stuff. And then there's like the human aspect, the soul aspect, and just how those things are kind of in struggle with each other constantly.
Because these characters are discarded. They themselves are kind of trash. And they talk about that. It's like, what does it mean to be thrown away? What does it mean to be secondhand? But it's also an excuse to just have incredible production design in this film. And it's like a childlike. You've mentioned, I think, that at least one of your daughters would like build things. Building robots, I think, is what you said. And that she'd like put what building robots was to her was like just stacking up random things. Haven't you talked about that?
Yeah, they do that. Yeah, we call them projects where they'll like just collect stuff and put it next to each other or on top of each other and say what it is. So robots is one. Yeah, she'll like... To her, a robot is like a bunch of things that you put on together and you pretend that it's alive, basically.
Well, I know that my little brother would do that. I think he might have said experiments or projects or something, too. It has a Calvin and Hobbes sensibility. Like, put all these things together and it will become something more than the sum of its parts. Like this grand realization, this grand creation, even though it's... whip stitched together from a bunch of trash wrappers. And in the featurette, they talk about how actually all the stuff is put together with real building materials, and that then the like the fake, you know, the kid whimsy structure of it is all exterior, you know, added after the fact to make it look that way. But I love the look.
It also like gradually builds this film-wide joke, I guess you could call it, or like irony. So you said that it's never revealed how he got stranded on an island. It gradually comes to light that he's like in civilization. He's like right on the edge of it. You can walk for 15 minutes and be back in the heart of it. So for as much as this is like out in nothingness, stranded from everything, it's like he sees headlights and stuff. He's right there. He's right in the middle of it. So...
spoilers. I was going to give a double spoiler warning before we got there that...
Oh, sorry.
Space is inflated. Things are not as we perceive them, although I'm not exactly sure how they really are. A recurring element of these lessons that Hank is presenting to Manny is a girl. he's got a picture of this woman on his cell phone, Hank's phone. And we learn that this woman's name is Sarah. And the way it's presented to Manny, the corpse who's becoming alive, is, well, we don't know who you are, Manny. You could have this whole life that you need to be reconnected with back in civilization. And maybe you are connected to this woman. But through flashbacks, the viewer is seeing that actually Hank is the one who kind of sort of knew this woman, although it was a parasocial thing. Like, he sat not far from her on a bus for a while and took a creeper shot on his cell phone of her somewhere along the way, and has developed this whole, you know, one-sided, in-the-mind relationship.
To me, this is more of the double spoiler warning on this one, because, like, the way that we meet Sarah is as a cover image on his phone. So, like, you know, I have a wife, my wife is a cover image on my phone. Usually don't have a picture of someone unless you're close with them, let alone have it be the cover image on your phone. And even the shot itself, it's not like very obviously like a faraway shot or like a creeper shot. And it's definitely left ambiguous what their relationship is. But like, to me, the implication from the start is that she's Paul Dano's ex, basically, or like they were together at one point. Or maybe like she died on whatever this thing is that stranded Paul Dano or something. But like they really were like intimately connected, you know?
Yeah.
And that's one reason, like the whole thing where he tries to convince Manny that maybe he's connected to Sarah, it didn't quite register for me. Although I do kind of get it from a thematic aspect, because like if you view Manny in some ways as like an extension of Hank processing things himself, he has to tell things to Manny that he himself needs to hear, you know? So it kind of works that way. But I didn't quite understand what was going on with that angle of trying to convince Manny that maybe Sarah was his girlfriend or something like that, too. Because we know that, or we assume at least, that he was together with Sarah.
Right. Important that you said that Manny is kind of an extension of Hank. Also, though, like early on, Hank is asking Manny what the girl's name is, like he didn't know. And so that was kind of unusual.
Yeah, it's definitely a little confusing exactly what's going on there at first.
Mm-hmm. But also you could read it that she's kind of presented as the, like, paragon of a woman, like the platonic ideal. This is what you strive for when you're alive.
And if you're going to cast someone to be that, I think you could do a lot worse than Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Okay, yes, it's Mary Elizabeth Winstead. So let me say that the way this woman is presented is like Ramona Flowers in Scott Pilgrim. Oh, she's some pretty girl that you see on a bus, and can you establish a relationship with that person? Kind of the same thing in, what was the Jim Carrey one we watched?
Oh, what's that called? Eternal Sunshine?
Eternal Sunshine. Girl, pretty girl on the bus. Which, I don't know that pretty girls actually take the bus. I think there's a stigma against public transportation, at least in this country. I think they try to avoid the bus. But anyhow, this watch through, I was like, oh, she's like Ramona Flowers. Oh, wait, that actually is Ramona Flowers.
Have you seen Die Hard 4, Live Free or Die Hard?
I haven't seen any of the Die Hards.
Oh, wow, man. Well, Die Hard 4 is actually my second favorite of the bunch. That is not a consensus opinion at all, but I really like it. You can almost even separate it from being a Die Hard movie because Bruce Willis is so old and it's a different creative crew. Other than Bruce Willis, there's really no connection to Die Hard. But Mary Elizabeth Winstead plays his daughter, and that movie came out when I was 19 and saw it in theaters. And that to me was like one of the crushes of my young adulthood.
And she married Ewan McGregor of Trainspotting.
Oh, man. Downgrading her in my head now. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but no, she was in that recent Star Trek show where she played a Twi'lek. And there were memes about how she was with Obi-Wan.
Interesting. Well, she's been in a few things. She stars in 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh, that's right.
Which is the unrelated spinoff or quasi-related spinoff of Cloverfield. And then she had a drama 5 years ago. It's like called All About Nina or something like that I was interested in just because it was starring her.
And in this film, she's very much kept at a distance.
Yes.
We don't learn a whole lot about this character, except a bit towards the end. So we've talked about what we're seeing with all this production design and just the grandeur of the natural world, because they're wandering through this forest. And then that juxtaposed with these junk structures that they're putting together, which still have a childlike wonder, which there's an aspect of that to Manny's personality, that he's starting to see the world for the first time. And it's like Frosty the Snowman coming to life. Happy birthday! But what are we hearing? So the soundtrack in this film, I like a lot. And it's a lot of voice sounds, like mouth sounds, like ba 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 da 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 da, and layered voices. So just like all the set pieces are whipped together from a lot of little pieces of trash, there are tiny components, like cheap organic components coming from just two dudes making noises that are then layered and built into something impressive and artistic. And part of this was that they actually composed the music before they shot the film, which is pretty unusual. And then they could be blasting the music on loudspeakers when they were filming so that the characters could sing along.
So one thing I learned from the commentary is that they had a kind of informal consultant on the score and then the sound design. And that is K.T. Tunstall. Do you know who K.T. Tunstall is?
Tell me.
She's a Scottish musician who had like a minor hit in the early 2000s called Black Horse in the Cherry Tree. And she has another sort of hit, Suddenly I See, that I like both those songs a lot.
I actually know that one, the Suddenly I See.
But she's Scottish and probably my second favorite Scottish person behind Andrew Milne, a.k.a. Thrash.
Oh, not Ewan McGregor?
Oh, no. K.T. Tunstall tops Ewan McGregor, I think. But anyways, she was trying to get into like film scoring and film sound design and connected with Daniels. I think they were both. So Sundance, which I'm going to talk about more in a later episode. Sundance kind of was a big incubator for talent. And they had like these workshop things where a lot of like really big deal directors basically like got their start. And so a lot of people kind of cross paths in these things. And this is where K.T. Tunstall and Daniels cross paths, was at like this Sundance talent incubator thing.
Yeah, I think Sundance is still a big deal.
I mean, it's still a pretty big deal, but I think it's lost some of its like, you will get the next big voice of cinema out of it that it had up until the early 2000s. I think now it's mostly just like kind of indie film. Maybe one of these movies will get an Oscar nomination, but in general, there's like a Sundance vibe more so than the heart of indie cinema.
Fair enough. I mean, I'm sure it's become like everything else, you know, commercialized. Once something gets popular and influential, the big brands are going to move in on it. And also just so many more films get made these days. There's so many venues. It's hard for anything to really break out.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't mean to take a dump on Sundance. If I were to go to any film festival, Sundance would probably be my first choice, just because I mentioned Sundance has kind of a reputation for a certain kind of indie film. It happens to be the kind of indie film that I really like, typically like a light drama or comedy type vibe. So I would definitely hit up Sundance.
Sure. As they're having this adventure together, Paul Dano is exploring Daniel Radcliffe's body. He's finding more and more uses for it, more powers that Manny has, and it will always be what he needs to get through a certain situation. So, like, Manny can snap his fingers and create a spark to start a campfire. He even has Buzz Lightyear's karate chop action. So that's what I was thinking of. In Toy Story 1, towards the end, like one of the features that Buzz Lightyear is advertised in his commercials as having is karate chop action. And Woody finds the button that activates the chopping arm, and he like uses it to battle Sid's toys. So he's like steering him around and controlling Buzz Lightyear's arm in a way that is separate from the control that Buzz Lightyear has over his own body. So that's what I was thinking of, is Hank can, like, push on Daniel Radcliffe's back and he'll lunge forward and chop through a log with his arm.
So, Brian, one thing that I put as a question that we could kind of talk through each week is, how old were these directors at the time of their debut, and what is their background? So we talked about how they made music videos, but as far as their age, they're about a year older than me, and therefore like 2 or 3 years older than you. And so filmmakers who are influenced by the same things that you and I were, and like one touchstone is they talk about Jurassic Park in here. And like you mentioned the music, they merge in the theme of Jurassic Park into the score, which is very funny when it happens. And anyways, I bring that up because you mentioned it's kind of like the Buzz Lightyear karate chop. That very well could have been the thing that they saw that made them think of this movie, or at least some parts of this movie.
Yeah, I believe it.
Because they would have been, you know, like 8 years old when it came out.
Another thing that Manny can do is if you load something in his mouth, he can fire it out like a shotgun or a cannon. And while they're discovering some of these powers, there's a song called Montage that I'll definitely link in our Discord related media section. But if you listen closely to the Montage song, they're like describing the things that are happening on screen. I'm using your body like it's a machine gun now, and we killed a raccoon. And it's a song that has got all these vocal layers to it.
By the way, Daniels must really like raccoons, or at least be fascinated by them, because they're prominent in both Swiss Army Man and Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Mm-hmm. That was probably what made me laugh the most in Everything Everywhere All at Once, where initially it's just a reference to like a misunderstood thing, where she calls Ratatouille raccoony. But then we learn there actually is a raccoony. It's like a real thing that exists in the infinite multiverses. So I want to dig a little into the themes of the story. We've mentioned some of them. But as much as Hank is bringing Manny to life, it's really that he's bringing himself to life and a greater appreciation of life. And the whole arc of this story is arguably the quest out of depression, or out of social isolation.
Completely agree. That if you were to like summarize it, I think there's a lot of ways you can slice it and dice it, but if you were to encapsulate it in one thing, it's whenever he is activating to life Manny, it's himself.
A couple times in past episodes, I've talked about Chris McCandless and... what was that movie? Into Thin Air? No, that's the Everest one.
Into the Wild?
Into the Wild, yes. Which I think may have actually been by the same author as Into Thin Air. But it was a true account of the McCandless story, who was this guy who went off into the woods to make his own way and live out there, and then he died because he was unprepared. And so some people embrace the romance of that, and a lot of people point out the stupidity of that. But I think especially like in American culture, there's this myth of rugged individualism that we see value in and valor, which, you know, there's holes you can poke in that image. It's like the Teddy K school of life. You know, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Oh, who's Teddy K? We have a friend named Teddy. And a friend named Paul K. But...
yeah, I'm on a first name basis with him, but he would go out and live in the woods and rebel against industrialized society and its consequences. But an anthropologist would rebut that vision, that ideology of rugged individualism, by saying really what people evolved to be was social animals. Like, if we were made to exist in isolation, we never would have had language. The very fact that we have an ability to express a thought from our head into somebody else's head suggests that that was like a really important trait to have. If you were a baby born out in the wilderness, I mean, you wouldn't even be able to feed yourself. But let's say you were like an isolated cave kid born to an isolated cave mom and you had some kind of sustenance, you would just never come up with language. You would never or it would be unintelligible. There would be things missing if you originated in isolation.
I read this book, Sapiens, which is pretty interesting. It's pretty popular. It wouldn't surprise me if someone who's listening to this has read Sapiens as well. But one of the things he talks about in there in that vein is how what really separates humans from animals is humans' ability to collectively understand and perceive things that are not physical. So like laws, for an example, like we kind of all know what laws are, but they're not a thing. You can hold a piece of paper that has a description of a law, but the piece of paper is not the law itself. What the law really is a collective understanding between a group of people on how it works. And concepts like nations, concepts like property lines. I mean, sometimes those are physically demarcated with like, oh, the stream breaks up my yard from your yard. But very often it's just like, we know where it is and that this is my space and that is yours. And that's maybe not a good example because it's a physical thing. But like so many of the concepts that allow us to unite and like build great things, like science and knowledge, so a lot of that stuff is not physically represented.
Right. They exist because we agree they exist.
Exactly. Yeah. Well said. And yeah, you can't really have that if it's just you or just you and a corpse in the woods.
Hank and Manny start bonding and getting close, and then they even start making out, which I actually forgot about. But I think there's different ways you can read this. Like, are they gay? Is Hank trans because, like, Paul Dano dresses up as the woman to portray her in their lessons? I don't think of it quite that way. Because I think it's so much that Hank is falling in love with himself or learning to appreciate himself, or at least his creation, which falling in love with your creation is kind of arguably the same thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting how their relationship evolves. And Daniels, I just think of them as being so maximal, both in the design, but even in the like the themes and like the concepts that they're digging through. And how the way that they don't leave it as just the simple thing, they constantly are expanding what their relationship looks like. So at the start, it's almost more of like a parent-child relationship, like teaching someone how to behave in the world. And you have to teach them basic rules of respectability, there are some things you don't say to other people, and there are ways that you dignify other people, and here's how you eat and here's how you poop and oh, these are forbidden things that we don't talk about with other people, etc. And then, yeah, sometimes they're like friends, and then sometimes it's like a creator creation or maybe like a pet and a pet owner. And then, yeah, they're also very clearly, they being Daniels, playing on like romantic comedy structure and tropes, like parts of the way that their relationship evolved, there being Hank and Manny, is that kind of like a romantic comedy. There's even the moment where like they're kind of connecting and they lean in for the kiss, but then the kiss doesn't quite happen. Now, in this case, the reason the kiss doesn't happen is because Daniel Radcliffe's corpse head like starts dangling on its side. And so Paul Dano can't quite kiss it. But they're definitely playing with that imagery too. And I also think like they're almost two parts of the human soul. It's like the physical aspect and the soul aspect that are merging as the movie goes, sort of. It's a very interesting dynamic.
It's also like a weird twisted version of the Pygmalion and Galatea story. It's like you make the perfect partner for yourself and fall in love with it because it's something that you made for yourself.
Right.
I mean, already it's a twisted story from its beginning.
And actually, now I'm thinking about it, I brought up Frankenstein earlier, but there is some Frankenstein to this. And I would imagine that even more of Poor Things, which I haven't seen yet, but that's the Best Picture nominee by Yorgos or whatever his name is, with Emma Stone as the Frankensteinish creature.
Yeah, I'm curious about that one. Also, I think Daniel Radcliffe was in a Frankenstein movie at some point, wasn't he? Wasn't it called I, Frankenstein or something? I think he played the doctor in that one. We got to look that up.
Interesting, maybe. Maybe, yeah.
And just like any romantic comedy worth its salt, you gotta have the late second act breakup where something happens that mars the magic and makes it so they can't be together. So Manny learns that actually it was Hank who had the kind of sort of connection with this woman in his past life. It actually has nothing to do with Manny, which we've basically known all along, that this woman was in Hank's past somehow. Also, we find out, and I don't know how long Hank has known this, it's a little unclear to me, but he like finds her Instagram and learns that this woman has children, is married and has a kid.
Interesting that you say that. I did not read that from the Instagram scene. I read from the Instagram scene that she had a partner. Do they show the kids in the Instagram thing? Maybe they did, and I just didn't perceive that. But to me, it felt more like it's like an ex, like he's scrolling through it and he just sees, oh, there's the other person, the other man. Like maybe it's an ex or something like that. Because I think what we're about to get to kind of is the moment that was a gut punch for me.
Right. Yeah. So I guess different ways to read this scene, but it sets Manny off. He's upset. Why is she with that dude? Basically, just the knowledge that he doesn't have this connection. Manny doesn't have a pre-existing connection with Sarah that he's been led to believe. And another thing that annoys Manny is that Paul Dano has never farted around him. Refuses to fart by him, with him. And this theme that Hank is still too inhibited. That the true, beautiful way to live your life is uninhibited, untrammeled, unshackled by these restrictive rules of civilization. And that Hank needs to cut loose.
And for me, this really comes back to the whole duality thing. Like, what's the relationship between the elemental basics of our existence and how we view ourselves on the level of the soul and personhood in relationship with other people? But it's also just like an impish poop joke. It's like, oh, you got to fart near me because we love each other. Like, does that sentence funny to you? If that sentence is funny to you, then you're probably going to vibe with this movie.
So Manny is miffed and they've got this tension between them. But ultimately, Manny does stick up for Hank when they run into a real bear. There's a bear in this movie, Dan.
A real ass bear. I was like, hey! I was doing the pointing. I was so excited. I love real ass bears in movies.
And the bear starts mauling Hank and it looks like curtains. But Manny stands on his own two feet. Kind of. He starts becoming mobile of his own accord, and he battles this bear by lighting a fart and becoming this, like, flaming fireball and scaring the bear away. I liked in the featurette this bit where they cover Daniel Radcliffe in the, like, fireproof Vaseline, and he's rolling around on fire.
Yeah, when your budget is $3 million, which, okay, $3 million is a lot of money, but when you're making a movie, that's really not that much money. And you can only go so far with the special effects, and there's very little CGI in this, which I think adds to its charm, that so much of it is practical. Like the bubbles in the water, it's real. They're air pump. They made a fake Daniel Radcliffe and shot fart bubbles out of the fake Daniel Radcliffe's butt, and that's why you see it. Shooting bubbles out when there's a fake Daniel Radcliffe in the water. There's no computer gimmickry there. Can you imagine the Marvel Cinematic Universe creating fake, like, practical fart bubbles?
Yeah, they'd just be in a big blue screen room.
Exactly, yeah.
These are farts with heart. They come from the soul.
Fart with Heart would be a decent episode title for this.
Hank passes out from his bear injuries. But when he comes to, now it's Manny carrying him through the woods. And where Manny drops him off, much to his apparent horror, is in Sarah's backyard, which, as Dan let out of the bag a little while ago, reveals to us, seemingly, that all of this has happened on a much smaller scale than we've been led to believe.
But I just want to say that's not really like a, I don't know. This is the tipping point, of course, because, you know, they could literally just walk there. But it's like a gradually dawning thing that you're like, wait, what the hell's going on here? Like, how come they can see headlights? How come there's trash coming out of all this stuff? Wait, are they actually like, could they can walk up that hill and there's a road there? Like, what's the big deal? So, yeah. But then it is like a jump scare, basically, when what we're in her backyard right now, like for real.
Yeah, I was surprised that they even knew where she lived. But now they're in the yard and they both briefly talk to the daughter, who's like this. How old would you guess the daughter was? Like 5, 7,
I was going to say something.
Like okay.
That. Yeah. One thing from the commentary I learned is that they actually initially were going to have a whole segment of Manny carrying Hank and mirroring stuff that had already happened in the movie. But they said, we were starting to feel like this was Return of the King, where we had so many logical ending points and we just kept extending it. And I think it was probably the right decision to go straight from the bear to he wakes up and they're in Sarah's yard. Because the runtime actually is pretty brisk. You're hitting credits like only a couple minutes after 90 minutes, after an hour and a half.
Yeah, our episode may end up longer than the movie. But partly because Manny is alienated that Hank won't fart around him, he resumes a corpse state. He apparently dies again and is unresponsive, just like Mr. Snuffleupagus. This is when the adults who are important and need to see what's going on come around the corner and suddenly the magic man is gone. The invisible friend has disappeared. So Mary Elizabeth Winstead walks out and is hearing Hank's tale from Hank with no Daniel Radcliffe to back him up other than that the corpse is lying there on the lawn and this dirty woodsman has emerged. And what do you do with this guy who has wandered in out of nowhere, disheveled and injured and with a dead guy?
And I don't know quite when we get like the exact revelation, and maybe I don't want to jump on your points if you're about to get to this here, but she's married, has been the whole time, has a kid. Like, there is no relationship between Hank and Sarah. She doesn't even recognize him. It's not even like they were friendly on the bus and he imagined it. She didn't know who he was. So like this whole, she's been like the guiding light. Literally, he turns on the phone when he thinks he might be getting close to society and looks at her picture to see if he's close enough to society that he can re-enter it. And what does he see? He sees her face, but she doesn't even know who he is.
But because he obviously needs medical attention, there are quickly other people on the scene. So Hank's dad comes, who he's got this estranged relationship with his father that was mentioned. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead's husband comes out and the local news shows up. So there's all these people around and Hank is grappling with, oh, Manny's dead again, and people need to know this story of what happened to me, which sounds like, I mean, if you have never seen the trailer of this film, like, what would you think hearing it described?
Yeah.
Well, even if you've seen the trailer, what would you think? And, yeah. So there's this crazy guy raving now. Our protagonist appears, very unsound. At first, though, there's like this little window of time where the news is interviewing him as a survivor, as somebody who's at least done this like maybe heroic thing, has survived in the wilderness, has emerged, has undergone this traumatic thing. But suspicion quickly turns against Hank because Sarah sees the picture of herself on his phone and he clearly knows a lot about her. And then the investigators take a look, and the camp, Hank and Manny's camp, is like 200 feet from the house, it seems. It's really close. So then you ask yourself, well, wait a minute. Has he just been camped out, watching her, stalking her the whole time? Based on his reaction when Manny carries him into the backyard. Like, did he know the whole time that he was right here?
Right, because it's... he like takes the corpse and runs off with it, which is already a funny sight gag, and doesn't ever quite get old throughout the course of the movie. You get a little bit used to it, but still him grabbing a dead human body and trying to run away with it. And he like drops it on the ground and it sloped down and it's like dangling, flopping around. He's like kind of riding it down too. It's just, it's really bizarre. And yeah, they're like immediately right down in the valley, but I think it's ambiguous because it's also got a surreality to it. It made me think a little bit of like Mulholland Drive, because there's this whole bit that it was a little half-baked. I didn't quite get what they were going for with it, where for like a minute or two, they think that the dead body is actually Hank and he's Manny. And then they correct it. But like this whole sort of like identity swap thing, I thought it was actually going to be a twist that turns out he was Manny all along and he kind of invented Hank as a person or something. I don't know exactly what it was going to be, but the whole way where it's, there's some confusion about the name and like the swapping of identities.
Or what it made me think of was Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Oh, good. I was going to say The Swimmer too, where The Swimmer also has like this not quite believable reality of the spaces connecting all the different scenes that we see.
Mm-hmm. That's a great example. I didn't think of that one. Where you kind of get a fuller picture once the journey is done, but still don't quite have all the pieces.
Exactly, yeah.
And so Hank is running off. Like you said, he toboggans back down the hill on Manny's corpse and begging him to come back to life. It's like they're trying to escape back into Oz or something, or Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing for me here in reality. Got to get back to the fantasy space. And they just wind up slumped on the beach. And Hank is still pleading with everybody, no, no, you gotta believe me. He's a farting magic man. He's the Swiss Army man. And they're cuffing Hank, gonna take him into custody. And Hank realizes what he has to do is fart. Fart loud and long. And that's what brings back the Frosty the Snowman magic. And Manny's motor butt roars to life in the surf. And then the whole crowd is looking over. It's like the pirate ship coming out of the cove in the Goonies, and suddenly everybody believes. Suddenly everybody on the beach is witnessing the miraculous thing that the kids know about. Because Daniel Radcliffe putters out to sea, and he's got this big grin now on his face. Presumably he's going to go off to the other side of the world and save some other lives, some other desperate people who need Manny and his Swiss Army man body.
One thing I thought about when I was watching this ending is, in some ways, so that you mentioned that they have the camera footage to like hear Hank tell his story. And so there's, as they're running through the woods, there's this cameraman chasing after them too. And it's almost like the final scene is like the telling of the making of this movie, because it kind of recreates the opening where Manny comes to life and motorbutts. And also there's like disbelieving people watching and a cameraman, and some people are digging it and like, oh, this is cool. And other people are like, what the hell is this? And I was like, oh, this is basically the movie in micro with like the creation and the reaction to it right over here too.
That's really perceptive. I like that. We're taking a step back, seeing behind the scenes.
And just seeing the absurdity of it from fresh eyes again, I guess.
Yeah. Right. We've been steeped in this. Again, it's telling us when you live your life in isolation, you develop like this whole other language that makes sense to you. But with no external frame of reference, it's just going to be madness.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what happens to Hank after the credits roll, Dan? What is next in Paul Dano's life in this story?
That's a good question. I mean, or is he actually dead the whole time? And this is just him actually entering the escape of the chains of life. I don't know.
Yeah, hard to say what exactly is true and what isn't, because he never actually talks to the dad.
I would say if we were to take it at face value and that everything that we just saw is literally as it was perceived, I think he would be arrested and have a rough couple of years, but I think he would redevelop his relationship with his dad. And I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead would file a restraining order against him.
That's pretty much what I think, too.
Okay. That's your take.
Yep.
And he would often dream of Manny.
That's Swiss Army Man from 2016. So, broad strokes, Dan. What are you thinking? What are you feeling?
A couple more thoughts. So, at some point, I want to connect this back to Everything Everywhere All at Once, because I think there's some shared thematic tissue. One thing I wanted to say, so in the commentary, the big fart that Paul Dano lets out, Daniels call it the Apocalypse Now fart, because they wanted it to sound like the helicopters encroaching in Apocalypse Now with the same like earth-shattering Foley soundscape to it, the one epic Paul Dano fart. And by the way, in the featurette, you get some footage of like how they made the pants vibrate. And it's pretty funny, pretty interesting.
I also liked watching Daniel Scheinert conduct Daniel Radcliffe coming back to life on the beach with the fart, because he said that the intensity needed to build. And so there's a shot of him standing outside of the camera range and literally waving his arms like a baton. Okay, bigger, bigger. And Daniel Radcliffe is hopping around on the beach.
Yeah, definitely. One other connection I wanted to bring into this movie is Babylon. I thought of Babylon a bunch of times, particularly the film's obsession with bodily fluids and like how that is connected with creating something sublime, because that's a thing in Babylon. I've thought a lot about Babylon since we talked about it, and I haven't gone back and listened to what we said, but I feel like I would refine and twist some of my thoughts on Babylon. I might even bump it up to a 7. I gave it a 6, but so much of that movie is about like the literal bodily fluids and bodily functions that the characters pour into the creation of the movies. And that, like, it literally opens with Manny getting shit on by an elephant as a way to actually allow Hollywood to function, to get that elephant up the hill. And there's some of that in this too, where it's just like, I know I've already said it, but the necessity of all of the stuff of the body. And to me, I kind of said, like, if you were to summarize the theme, I liked the bit you had about the depression and how, like, as Manny comes to life, so Paul Dano kind of comes to life metaphorically and escapes his depression somewhat. But I think another aspect, another way you could kind of spin it, is it's like the tug of war between nihilism and human connection. And I think you see that even more starkly in Everything Everywhere All at Once, but like this awareness that like the physical biological reality is you're alive and then you're dead. And then once you're dead, you're dead. You're not alive anymore. Even though we have this corpse that's kind of like toying with that assumption, but like you live and then you die and then you decay. And so like, what's the purpose of life? Like, why does it matter? But like, teasing out some meaning of that. Like, how do you make meaning of that biological fact about how everyone lives a short life and then dies? And to me, that is like what the movie is about, really, is like that struggle.
An extension kind of that idea is I see themes in this about what does it mean to be a creator? Because being a creator, I went to somebody's, like, art major. Well, it was a music major, and they played, like, an organ concert in an old church as their final thesis project thing. And in his speech presenting this concert, he talked about how the Bible says that God made man in his image. And what does that mean? Does that mean that God looked like a human being? Or that a human being looks like God's physical form? And he said what he thought it meant was that God created humans with the ability to create. So if you think about creators, they have kind of an inherent authority. But like, who gives them that authority? Why should they get to create a world? Why should they get to give characters a kind of crude pseudo life? Like, as we see in this story, this guy's a nobody. And he has the power to teach about life. And he's making things, but he's making things out of trash. And it's a microcosm of the larger movie.
I like that. It's like, it kind of all feeds together. I think that's well said. It really is the grandest and most beautiful farting corpse movie that she could make. So I want you to hear your thoughts on Everything Everywhere All at Once, because I don't know how I would have reacted to Swiss Army Man if I hadn't seen it. I think I would have been more surprised at the thematic content than I was, but I definitely would have reacted very differently if I hadn't already seen a Daniels film. So what was your take going from A to B instead of B to A?
Right. Everything Everywhere All at Once. I just recently watched it, so I'll try to keep my thoughts brief. It's a much longer movie. It was like 2 hours and 15 minutes or something, which isn't super long, especially by these days' standards. I didn't like it quite as much, and I have some ideas as to why. It felt to me like it was more of drawing on established movies, because there was a lot of kung fu movie in it. I mean, it was definitely an unusual kung fu movie, and very visually creative. I loved the editing, definitely deserved the editing Oscar, like more than just about any movie that I've seen, although I really loved the editing in Swiss Army Man too, all these montages and things, and the way that the music was tied in. Something that I think it boils down to is that Everything Everywhere All at Once is very much about a family. Like, that's the big thing at its core, is how does a family relate, especially that it's an immigrant family, and they're trying to, like, hold on to their identity and keep a cohesive unit, even though in a new country there's new pressures and there's new social movements, and the idea between all the different ways that your life could go, and you settled on this way, and is that the right way? So I think, Dan, maybe you would relate to that story more, of this settled family, whereas I find myself relating more to the guy in the woods.
Interesting. I'm actually not sure which one I like more, I gotta say. I think in some ways I admire how out there and unique Swiss Army Man is, because Everything Everywhere All at Once, you're right, it's pulling in kung fu stuff. Multiverse is hot and kind of feels like a superhero movie in that regard. And I mean, having Michelle Yeoh or Yeo or however you say her name, who's like a well-regarded kung fu star doing kung fu stuff in there, is obviously important to the film, and like part of why it's so visually appealing. I think the fact that it's longer, also it just kind of accumulates a little more heft. Like the ending, the climax is basically like a 45-minute montage. Both of these movies use montage so much, and I don't know if that's inherently good or bad, but it like it's a distinct style. Say what you will about the Daniels and like criticizing them going over the top, or praising them for going over the top, but they definitely have a style and like a intensity that they do everything with. Both movies have something I kind of don't like, which is a sort of postmodern maximalist approach to the comedy, which is like, we know that this joke is dumb and we're just going to do it over and over again. And like, that's going to be funny because we're just going to take a dumb joke and do it over and over again. Like, it's the farts. And like, Swiss Army Man is almost like a deconstruction of that concept. So I kind of get it a little bit more. I mean, it's still ridiculous that you're watching a farting corpse for 90 minutes, but Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's got the hot dog fingers and Raccoon-y, and it just keeps doing them over and over again. Like, assuming that that will almost make it poignant or like make it rich at least. And I kind of feel like it doesn't. Like, it's, I don't know. I really do have some ambivalence, because like, I feel like when your movie is this over the top and like proud and unashamed of being the weird and off-putting thing that it is, then it's just kind of, I don't know what the right word is. It desensitizes it to you, and then is also just inherently kind of like abrasive or something. So I gave Everything Everywhere All at Once a 7, and I don't know if I would go that high if I were to rate it again when I reviewed it on my website. I have some mixed feelings about it. It's actually funny. It's like a day or two after I published that review, I actually woke up in the middle of the night and like sat up and was like, I should have given it a 5. It's like, I've never had that reaction before, but like, I sat up in bed, bolt upright.
Yeah, I think I would probably give it a 6. but I really have respect for the scale of everything that they were throwing at the wall. Although I almost think like they could have gone further with it because that it's so tied to this one specific family. It's like in an infinite multiverse, there could be any number of things. Like the only multiverse I think that we saw that really had a new figure in it was the Raccooniverse, because there's this other chef that we like hadn't seen before.
Another thing that movie does, as I thought more about it, is like it lays out its structure and then immediately stomps on its structure. The structure is, oh, we're going to like take something that happened in her life and see what it's like in another version. Like, oh, what if she didn't come to the US and instead grew up a kung fu star in China? And then like, oh, well, now we'll get to see other things. What would her life be like if she didn't buy a laundromat or something? But then they're like, nah, the other multiverses we're going to show are just like random bullshit out there stuff. What if everybody had hot dogs instead of fingers? Like it kind of loses the grip. I feel like it could have been a more structured interrogation of the life of the main character.
Right, right. The idea that in all her different lives, the same people keep showing up. It's like Halloween. Curtis, Jamie Lee Curtis is still in her life, whether it's as her enemy or her lover, or it's like if you went a different place and lived a different life, you just wouldn't have Jamie Lee Curtis in your life. But I guess they got it with such out there, all these crazy things happening, you got to keep it grounded somehow. So you got to keep it centered by this recurring cast of characters. I actually wondered if it was like the Tom Hanks one, Cloud Atlas, which I haven't seen before.
There is some connection there because you have the different realities and it's played by the same people, but different characters played by the same people. And so you kind of implicitly start drawing connections to them, even if they're not actually the same person. Yeah. A couple other things that tied them together. Like, I think that movie in particular, like one thing that my brother, Brad, is not Will who's been on the podcast, but my brother, Brad, who is very devout Catholic, and he actually was going to become a priest. And he's also very thoughtful about the way he consumes media. So I always value when he has like strong opinions about stuff, because it's usually an interesting take. And he really, really does not like multiverses because he finds them inherently nihilistic. Because basically no one decision you make and no one reality really matters, because, oh, you could just go to another universe and a different thing happened. It basically like strips away the meaning of things in the world, decisions you make. And I think Everything Everywhere All at Once captures that clash really well, because it like basically presents that face value and says, if you're in a world where like your decisions don't matter, in Swiss Army Man, the way it doesn't matter is you're going to die anyways. And in Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's that there's infinite universes. Like how does anything have meaning, and how do you find meaning in that? So I think they both kind of in different ways explore a kind of similar worldview, at least, which makes sense because they're both very personal films.
So are you ready to say whether it's good, Dan?
I have one last thing I want to say, and this one's back to Swiss Army Man, not Everything Everywhere All at Once. In some ways, this movie has the structure of a In the Mood for Love or Brief Encounter, where there are two people who kind of find each other. And at first they seem very different, but then they like kind of come to depend on each other for support. And that support turns into intimacy. And then at the end, because of life circumstances, now in this case, the life circumstances are one of them is a corpse and one of them is a person, as opposed to In the Mood for Love, where they're married to different people. But because of life circumstances, they can't actually be together in the long term. And so it's a very bittersweet ending where one person has to go off into the distance as the other person, the main protagonist, is stuck coping with the loss of that person.
I need to think about that for a while.
I'm not sure it actually lands. I just wanted to make Swiss Army Man be a one-to-one with In the Mood for Love.
You could be onto something, because when I was reading about Everything Everywhere All at Once, multiple places the directors said that they were influenced and kind of trying to capture some of the style of Wong Kar Wai.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But yeah, shall I talk us into Is It Good?
Okay.
So Is It Good is our signature section where we each give the movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, which is a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. So I guess I will go first. Is Swiss Army Man good? And kind of with Everything Everywhere All at Once, no one number feels quite right. I'm just in awe of the sweep of the storytelling and the dedication and the, yes, they are going to go there, but not necessarily out of like a puckishness really, or like an impishness, more out of like a dedication to treating their ideas as grandly, but also as intimately as they possibly can. And it really makes for something so unique. And I would say I'm going, like, you could make the case for almost any rating on the scale, and like from your viewpoint, make a rational defense of that, that I would accept as a rational evaluation of that film. I'm going to land on a very good, a 6 out of 8, because I just think it's so unique, and it really plumbs the setup for the maximum metaphoric and thematic value while still not sacrificing what it actually is, a farting corpse movie. It's always fully a farting corpse movie, but it is also so much more an examination of the human condition. Very good film for me, 6 out of 8. I could see bumping it down for just how silly it is to get to that point. I could see bumping it up even more if you really are vibing with it. But Brian, what about you? Is Swiss Army Man good?
I didn't know that I was going to give it this rating until I rewatched it. I remembered liking it. Plenty of movies on this podcast I bring in knowing I'm going to give a high rating. And I try to sprinkle those out throughout the year. Ones that I'm really familiar with, ones that are my favorites. I knew this one had more to it than met the eye, and that's why I wanted to discuss it. But watching it again, I really, really liked this movie. I'm giving it an 8, and probably the most solid 8 that I've given to something since Gravity Falls.
Wow. Toward a good.
It leaps into my favorites list somewhere, because I really think it's firing on all cylinders. It's not going to appeal to everyone. You gotta watch that trailer and see what you think, if you can handle that physical bodiness. Because it is part and parcel with the whole thing, and yet it manages to be this big piece of art that is really polished, and I love the music, and I love the editing, all these montages, and the way that Hank is projecting. He's got this bedsheet and he's projecting on it these simulacra of famous movies, which was the bit that made me think of Babylon. It's like in this quick montage, oh, now he's doing shadow puppets of Superman and Jurassic Park and E.T. and, you know, kind of both a parody of and a celebration of motion pictures. And what are we trying to say when we make movies? And are we able to exist by creating art in some way beyond our mortal husk? And like, I was having fireworks in my head. This, it vibes with me. It's got a lot of things in it that make it a quote unquote Brian movie. But yeah, it very much, I think you should go and watch this if we haven't spoiled it too much. Or just watch it again if you have seen it, because I think there's a lot of good stuff here.
Toward a good masterpiece from Brian. Exciting. I always love when we get something that inspires us to give an 8. That's great. Yeah, we'll see how this one sits with me over time. I feel some ambivalence in general to Daniels. I have a lot of appreciation for them, though. So do we want to loop back? Are there any other questions that we wanted to look at?
Oh, sure. We can revisit. But I just wanted to stress, I think it would be really hard to play the corpse in this movie. So major kudos to Daniel Radcliffe. It couldn't have been easy.
Excellent. I think we've talked a lot about how does this foreshadow or represent their future work with the connections to Everything Everywhere All at Once. And we've talked some about the legacy and reputation of it. It sounds like favorite-wise, you have this one above Everything Everywhere All at Once.
For me, I would say that, yeah. But what about you?
I'm really on the fence. I kind of have them in a similar tier. I guess by rating, I have on the books a 7 for Everything Everywhere All at Once and a 6 for this. But I really think they're doing different things. And this is why it's worth watching multiple movies by the same director. Because especially like in close conjunction or with both of them deep in your thought, because you can really, it's like auteur theory. You can see the way that they're teasing through ideas and you actually get a bigger picture of it by looking at multiple movies in conjunction, multiple pieces of art together. So as far as what we will check out by them next. I definitely recommend the Turn Down for What. In some ways, that's like my favorite little blast of Daniels is the Turn Down for What video. But Brian, have you heard of the movie called Omniboat, A Fast Boat Fantasia?
No.
So I was reading about this. I only discovered it today when I was Googling Daniels. And it was this movie made in 2020. So in between their two films. It's an anthology film. I think that Daniels might have been like the chief organizers of it, but it's got a huge cast of directors and then a huge cast of actors. Some recognizable ones, like you have Phil Lord of Lord and Miller was one of the people contributing to it. Robert Redford directed part of it. He also co-stars in it. Here is the pitch. The film is made up of several different stories chronicling the life of Leyen Pipe, a 47-foot Top Gun cigarette boat from its conception through the end of human civilization. And I was like, okay, that actually has some Daniels vibes to it in the way they describe it.
There's another movie. So these two films, The Swiss Army Man and EEAAO,
Yow,
were their two features. Like, that's it. And they spent a lot of time on Everything Everywhere All at Once because obviously it was a big undertaking. But there was one in between that was just by Scheinert. And it's called like The Ballad of Dick Long or The Life of Dick Long. So certainly there's like a recurring sophomorishness to the humor.
Did we talk about the joystick controlled Daniel Radcliffe penis?
We actually did not. So what needs to be said? There is that. A prehensile penis that points their way through the wilderness, and the directors had a way to control it with like a puppet joystick.
Yeah, it's like a compass. It like points him back to civilization, which we actually learned to be to points him to Sarah's house, which I think is maybe is definitely appropriate for what we learn about how he's processing his connection to the world through Manny.
In the featurette, they did talk about the dick mechanism for a while. They said, we did a music video where we did the same thing by poking a broom handle into his pants from behind, but we didn't have that kind of access in this movie, so we needed to do it remotely.
That would be the Turn Down for What video, by the way. Lots of broomsticks poking through pants in that one. Well, that was an interesting one, Brian. So for the third week, the middle week of debut month.
What do you got?
I am going to send you a list of shorts to watch. So these are shorts by directors. I need to decide if I'm going to unify them around a single theme or just give a collection of great directors or famous directors for shorts. Because I have a couple of ideas of how I could theme them. I have a long list of ones that are under consideration. I think it's interesting how many great directors' first output were shorts, which makes sense in a lot of ways. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And mainly this will be a way for us to talk about some directors that we've either not talked about or only talked about a little from like a career retrospective sort of way. So this will kind of be like a little platter. I always like to cram some film history into our theme months. So yeah.
And I like to shove some farting corpses in.
Film history and farting corpses, yeah. Really, they're one and the same, if you ask me. Reanimating life.
Well, thank you, listeners, for joining. This was a fun one. And join us again for The Goods.